Science.
Film.
Ethics. Performance.
Conversation.
Music.
On RN.
And welcome to Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you today, coming from the Comedy Theatre in Melbourne in collaboration with the Wheeler Centre. A very special interview this morning. Barbara Arrowsmith-Young is a courageous self-experimenter. It's her own story, her own experience that's led her to shape the lives of countless others and to shape their brains, quite literally. As she says, our brains shape us as we shape our brains. She also says, by changing the brain, we change how we learn. Makes good sense to us today. But when Barbara started experimenting with her own brain, a brain that had caused her immense distress for the first 26 years of her life, this idea that we can manipulate the physiology of our brain through exercising it pushed against every orthodoxy about the brain. An educational psychologist, Barbara is founder of the famous Arrowsmith School in Canada. It opened in Toronto in 1980. It's now a program in 35 schools in Canada and the USA, soon possibly two in Australia. And she tells her story in a new book, The Woman Who Changed Her Brain and Other Inspiring Stories of Brain Transformation. And she joins us for the full show today. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, there are many beginnings in your story, but let's start perhaps with the most important. Mm-hmm. You dedicate this book to the famous physiologist and psychologist, Russian, mm-hmm. Alexandra Luria,
yes.
Who only died in 1977. Why do you dedicate the book to him?
He was really my lifeline. It was in 1977 that I came across a book called The Man with the Shattered World, and it was a journal of a Russian soldier who had had a bullet wound in 1943 to a specific part of the brain, and Luria worked with this man named Zizetsky and chronicled his story. And when I read that, it was like reading my life on the page. I mean, all of the things that Zizetsky struggled with after his brain wound were the things that I couldn't do, like telling time, understanding language, just really processing meaning. I couldn't understand conversations. And it was the first time that I realized that it was what was wrong with me. I mean, I knew from grade one that there was something very wrong, but nobody had any kind of answer or explanation. And this was my first realization that here was what the problem was. It was part of my brain that wasn't functioning. And to create a solution for something, one has to understand what it is that's wrong. So it gave me tremendous hope that if it was a part of my brain that wasn't working, maybe there was a possibility that I could do something to change that.
Well, it more than gave you hope, it totally changed your life.
Yes, it did.
Barbara, you came into the world an asymmetrical baby.
Yes. I have one arm that, never straightened, an eye that didn't really function properly. I couldn't really function on this whole left side of my body. I couldn't register where sensation was coming from. I could put my hand on a burner and I would know that there was pain, but if I wasn't looking at it, I wouldn't know where it was. Very uncoordinated and clumsy. And it was really the asymmetry that was in my body was the asymmetry that was in my brain. Mm. So it was sort of written, in my physiology, and it was, really quite a struggle and quite painful growing up, just being different. I mean, I couldn't excel academically and I couldn't excel athletically. A lot of students with learning disabilities, if they're struggling academically, maybe they're good in terms of sports or athletics. I had neither avenue open. So yes, I mean, when I read Luria's work, it was an incredible revelation that maybe I could do something about this.
Well, in a sense, you describe the whole left side of you as foreign territory.
It was.
Felt like that, did it, on the inside?
It very much so. And it would do things that they talk about alien hand syndrome, right? I had alien left side syndrome. I mean, I remember once, I was trying to close a drawer with my right hand, and, for some reason this drawer wouldn't close, and I was feeling pain. I looked down and my left hand was in the drawer, and I was closing the drawer on that hand, but not recognizing it. Or I would you know, if I went to go and, you know, pick up this cup of water, I would end up, you know, pouring it mostly all over myself, or at times I couldn't inhibit the motion, so it, you know, would end up going over my shoulder. So this whole side of my body was really...
Like you'd had a stroke.
It was like I had a stroke. And I mean, my mother, I remember saying that she didn't think I would live past age 5 because I was constantly falling, you know, cutting myself, ending up in, you know, doctor's offices, getting stitches. It just did not function.
So what were your parents told about you?
In grade one, my teacher called my mother in and told her that I had a mental block and that I wouldn't learn like other children would. And at that point in grade one, being quite literal, I actually thought I had a piece of wood in my head, which I didn't, luckily, but I might as well have. I mean, I did have significant blockages in parts of my brain. So in grade one, I read everything backwards, wrote everything backwards. If I went to add numbers, if it was 12 plus 31, I would add it as 21 plus 13, and then I would reverse the answer. And my teacher really thought I was doing this deliberately. I mean, I got the strap in grade one. I mean, they didn't understand learning disabilities. I mean, there wasn't a concept of learning disability. I think the term was coined in 1962, so this was in the 50s. And, you know, I learned very early in grade one to do a lot of avoidant kinds of behaviors that I see children do. I spent a lot of time in the washroom, which the teacher didn't seem to mind. I guess if I was gone out of the classroom, she didn't have to deal with me. And my view of myself was that I was stupid, and that... You know, I could look at all of my other classmates, and they were able to learn things. I was labeled a turtle, which, you know, meant that I was, you know, moving pretty slowly in terms of academics.
Yeah, but you say slow, but you confused people too, because at different times you were described as gifted, at other times you were described as slow. So you had talent.
Yes, I definitely had strengths. I mean, I had a phenomenal visual memory and a phenomenal auditory memory. Almost the visual was like photographic and the auditory was verbatim. And I think I was probably born with those good memories in place, and then I used them to compensate for my deficits. So I think I really, unbeknownst to myself, created my own exercises very early to stimulate my brain and work those areas. So I would memorize everything. I didn't understand anything. And depending on how well, if I was doing an exam, if I could understand the question or somewhat understand the question and then match it up to what I had memorized, at times I might get 80%, but other times if I didn't do a good match, I would get 10%. And of course, the teachers would think that if I could get 80% once, I should be able to do that all the time. So if I was getting 10%, it must mean I wasn't trying hard enough. And I became a workaholic in grade one. I mean, I would come home at lunch because the school was right across the street, and I would do schoolwork. I would come home after school and do schoolwork. I mean, it took that amount of effort and energy just to tread water.
You're tenacious.
Yes.
Because Barbara went to graduate school. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine that you made it there. Mm. How did you make it there?
Through working 20 hours a day and sleeping 4 hours a night. I had a whole ritual in university where I learnt the routines of the guards in the library, and I would hide out as they were doing their checks at night. Like, I would either hide out in the washroom, I'd hide out under my cubicle, and continue to study long after the library was closed because it was quiet. So it was brute force and effort using my memory. And, you know, I did have incredible drive and determination. And in my family, it was just accepted that all of us were going to go to university. It was sort of an unwritten rule, so I felt I didn't have a choice. But at tremendous cost. I mean, there were lots of times of despair. One point, you know, attempting suicide. Other points,
this
seriously
was in your,
considering it.
Mid to late teens, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yeah. Yes, 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 yeah. Yes. I just, you know, points felt like I couldn't go on. Like there were the amount of effort it was taking, and the social isolation. I mean, because I didn't understand, it was like when people would talk to me, it was almost like a foreign language. If there was any complexity beyond, you know, that it's sunny out today, or, you know, the chair is red, which is very concrete, I struggled with understanding it. So it was very socially isolating. So I didn't really have friends.
It's a hard terrain to go to revisit, I imagine, in some ways, but you've moved so far beyond it. I have to read the psychoanalyst and psychiatrist Norman Doidge, who, of course, has written your story in his very famous book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and has drawn a lot of people to the school that you now run in Toronto. But he describes you as bold, ingenious, tormented, driven, and deeply empathetic as a pioneer. The torment is interesting.
Yes, I think it's very accurate. I was tormented by the struggles and the challenges and the isolation, and you know it still is there to some extent. I mean, I was 26 when I created the exercise. I used to have this naive belief that, you know, you address the cognitive piece and all the emotional aspects should just drop away, but they don't. I mean, it's sort of almost bred in the bone, in a sense of for all those years feeling like I was incompetent, that I was unintelligent. It takes a long time to get over those feelings.
So let's come to when you were 26 and you read this paper by Alexandra Luria, the book by Alexandra Luria, and you're blown out of the water. And you also read a key study about rats' brains.
Yes.
Tell us about that and why that also just went, oh my God, made you just reconsider the possibility for yourself.
Yes, that was Mark Rosenzweig's work in Berkeley, and he was working with rats and the whole concept of neuroplasticity. So he put one group of rats in a very enriched environment, like a cage with lots of toys to play with, and then this other poor group of rats just in, I guess, a cage with not much to play with. And what he found was the rats that had all the stimulation learnt better on mazes, which is like a little rat IQ test. And then, of course, because they were rats, he could sacrifice them after the experiment, and he looked at their brains. And the rats that had been in the enriched environment and had all the stimulation had more dendrites, so more branching on the neurons, which means more efficient communication. They had more neurotransmitters, more glia cells. So the brain had changed physiologically, which allowed that better learning. And then he did a really interesting experiment. He took a group of rats and he blindfolded them and he put them in a very tactile sensory environment. And when he looked at their brains afterwards, it was a part of the brain that responded to sensory, to tactile stimulation that had changed. And for me, then a light bulb went off. Like if you could find an activity to sort of differentially stimulate a specific part of the brain, you could change it. And I had to believe that humans had more neuroplasticity than rats did.
See, this was heresy. Why?
Because people, first of all, at that time, this was in 1978, weren't looking at the brain at all in terms of learning disorders. So first to say that is a part of the brain that isn't working properly was heretical, and then to say you can actually go in and potentially change that part of the brain, that through targeted stimulation or targeted exercise, you can change the brain physiologically, which then allows that part of the brain to learn, to process information, to do whatever it's supposed to do, you know, efficiently, effectively.
This is when you decided you didn't become a rat, but you did become a human guinea pig, quite literally, didn't you? And that flashbulb set you on a path of self-experimentation.
Yes.
Tell us what you did.
Well, I knew that I couldn't tell time. I'd never been able to read an analog clock. And when I'd read about Zazetsky, he had obviously been able to tell time before his wound, but as soon as he had been wounded in that part of the brain, he lost the ability to tell time. So I thought maybe that would be an activity. I mean, it was trying to find something that would work that part of the brain, and I didn't know whether it would work or not, but if we think about telling time, it's really processing relationships. I mean, you have to think about the hour hand and the minute hand, and that if it's 1:45, the hours move 3/4 of the way through, represented by the minute. So it's a relationship. And I thought, okay, I can't process relationships in general.
When you looked at the hands of a clock, they jumbled up.
They jumbled up. They didn't really have meaning for me. So I thought, if I can create an exercise with clocks, maybe I could do something in terms of working that part of the brain. And because I couldn't tell time, I had to have a friend help me with a watch and turn the hands of the watch to different times. And then I wrote them, on a piece of paper, like I drew the clock. Mm. And then I just got faster and faster at being able to look at those clocks and actually start to see the relationships. I mean, I probably worked 6-7 hours a day because, again, I was
obsessive.
Yes.
You imagine sitting there looking at the hands of a clock for 6 or 7 hours a day for days at an end?
Yes.
You were driven, weren't you?
I was very driven. I was desperate. I was at a point in graduate school where I was again thinking about suicide. I didn't know what my future would be. I just didn't think I could go on. So I was driven and I was desperate. And I figured this might be a possible way out of my problems. And as I got faster and faster at being able to process two hands, I thought, okay, I need to make it more complex. So I added a second hand. And so now there was 3 relationships I was processing. By the time I got up to 4 relationships, I added a fraction of a second. My whole world opened up. I started to be able to hear conversations and understand them as I was listening
to
them.
You feel through the process of this clock exercise?
Oh, 100%. I mean, there was nothing else I was doing, and I could take a book off the shelf and I could read a page, and I could understand it as I was reading. And what I always felt before and experienced was I lived in what I call lag time. I didn't live in real time because as I listened to things or read things in the moment, I couldn't understand them, and I would play them over like my tape recorder. I would play it over and over and over again, at times for hours after the conversation or after I'd read something, to try to come up with an understanding of what the meaning was. And now I could do it in real time. As I was reading, I understood. I mean, it was like an epiphany. I remember I couldn't listen to documentaries. I could listen to them, but I couldn't understand them. And there's the program 60 Minutes, and I had a friend that would always interpret and translate for me as I was watching those programs. And when I really knew that something had changed, is he was turning to translate, and I had already gotten, what they were talking about.
You are listening to Life Matters. This is ABC Radio National, and my guest today is Barbara Arrowsmith-Young. She is the founder of the Arrowsmith School in Canada, and her book is called The Woman Who Changed Her Brain and Other Inspiring Stories of Pioneering Brain Transformation. Barbara, what do you think, what was your hypothesis at the time? You were using Luria as your inspiration, as your guiding light, if you like. What did you think was going on in your brain?
I thought that I was changing it at a physiological level. I thought I was doing what those rats, had done with the stimulation. I thought that, what I was doing by the targeted exercise was actually going in and somehow, growing dendrites, like somehow at a physiological level, changing that part of the brain so it was able to process relationships. And after I saw that success, I thought, okay, I want to address, the dysfunctional left side of my body. So I created an exercise for that, which was very different. It was a whole process of doing things with my eyes closed, because for the sensory feedback, you have to know how far your muscles have moved.
So what did you do?
I created an exercise with like complex Chinese characters, figures, and I had to draw them as well with my eyes closed as I could with my eyes open, using the left side of like my left hand.
So it was sort of kinesthetic.
It was kinesthetic
sort of
absolutely.
Thing.
Because the only way you could do it was through the sensory feedback of how far the muscles had moved. And at first I was all over the place. I mean, it was a mess. And eventually, over time, I got to be as accurate with my eyes closed as I was with my eyes open. Mm. And And I've worked that exercise now with many, many people, and the whole ability of whichever side of the body it is now can start to process sensory information. And then I had the spatial deficit, so I decided, okay, I've done the reasoning and I've done the
human
kinesthetic.
Guinea pig.
Yes. So I created an exercise for that, and was able not to get lost. But it was more than just getting lost. It's the whole ability to think into three-dimensional space, which I couldn't do. For me, if something went into a drawer, it no longer existed. I could not visualize my way into three-dimensional space. But after working on that area, I could do those kinds of things. Or I wanted to study organic chemistry, and if you think about that, they're all the molecules that you have to build and construct spatially, and I hadn't been able to do that, or geometry. And so all of that shifted, and that's what really led me to believe I must be changing something fundamental, because it isn't just that I got better at the exercise. All of the symptoms related to that cognitive function shifted.
So not really that many years later, you decide to set up the Arrowsmith School, mm-hmm. in your name. Mm-hmm. What was the vision for the Arrowsmith School? Because here was an idea that pushed against, well, not just scientific orthodoxy, but also educational orthodoxy around learning disabilities, didn't it? And still does.
Yes.
To a great degree.
Yes. I mean, traditional, programs in special education are really, the premise is the learner is fixed, that there's strengths and weaknesses that the learner has, and that we have to adjust or modify the curriculum to match the learning strengths and learning weaknesses of the learner. What I feel and argue is that we can actually change the capacity of the learner, so then the learner can learn all aspects of curriculum. So, I mean, I set up the school because I wanted to help other people. A private school that struggled like I did. I felt like, I have a solution here for some very specific problems, not everything that's related to learning. And I wanted other people to be able to access that and benefit from it. And there was a lot of resistance at that time, yes, because that was 1980. I thought people would want to come in, like psychologists, various people, and see what I was doing, and nobody was really interested in coming in. And over time, the climate has shifted. I mean, we now understand about neuroplasticity, that our brains aren't fixed.
The climate has changed so much. I mean, neuroplasticity is the buzzword, isn't it, now?
Yes.
And I have to say, though, with that, I guess I've been tracking those conversations over the last decade, and you just get this sense that there are a lot of, there are a lot of people kind of marketing their own tools, mm-hmm. big time, mm-hmm. neuroplasticity tools, and they're marketing themselves as gurus. Mm. And that's a risk, isn't it?
It definitely is. I mean, especially working with people with learning disabilities, there's a lot of desperation there, as I know myself. And really, the programs need to come out of good science. And some of them do, and some of them don't. And it's hard sometimes to discern which is which.
You say that, and yet you were pushing against science. I mean, there wasn't really science you were kind of creating the science yourself in some respects.
In some respects, yes, but the science was there. It was buried in the labs. Like, I mean, Rosenzweig's work was there, and Luria's work was there in terms of identifying the function of different brain areas. So it was there, but it just wasn't commonly known.
Who walks through the doors of Arrowsmith today? And I mean, reading some of the stories, and there are lots and lots of stories, you get this real sense that They come to the school, they walk in those doors with a lot of grief and pain, and mm-hmm. A kind of lifetime of ostracism, that they've been told they're stupid. Or they've been diagnosed with ADHD, for example. Mm-hmm. That's very common too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I have a lot of students that, when they first come to me, are on medication for attentional problems. And in probably about 80% of the cases, by the end of the program, they're off the medication, because it, in my view, isn't true ADHD. It can be for a number of reasons. One, what I call cognitive load. They have a number of cognitive areas that are causing them difficulty. So every time they walk into that classroom, they're being asked to do things that take tremendous effort, just like what I was asked to do. And they get exhausted. And as soon as they get exhausted and they can't pay attention, their attention wanders, they start to engage in activities that probably their teacher would prefer that they don't engage in to avoid what's difficult for them. So they get labeled as having attentional problems and get medicated. And then the prefrontal cortex, like the executive function, both in the right and left hemisphere, which part of the function of those areas is sort of active, sustained engagement. And so if there's a cognitive deficit in either of those areas, very much you see the distractibility, that they can't sustain attention to completion of a task. They get pulled off by irrelevancies. And I have programs for those two areas. And as those come online, again, the attentional piece is addressed, so they don't need the medication. And then there are some students that truly are going to need medication, but it's a much smaller percentage than what I think gets identified and
you're medicated. Working with both adults and children.
Yes.
And I mean, a lot of people come to you and they've spent a kind of lifetime being told that they're just behaving badly, mm-hmm. that they're disobedient, don't they?
Yes.
And there are some particular deficits that seem to generate that expectation mm-hmm. of people, don't they? That they've just been behaving naughty. They're naughty.
Yes. Well, I mean, the problem that I had, the reasoning problem, if you don't really understand what's going on around you and misunderstand, you know, what people are saying, it can lead to behavioral problems, or again, the prefrontal cortex, that part of the brain, which allows like judgment, and that's, you know, the social problems, social judgment, where the person can't read the social cues, and so misinterprets what's going on. I remember one student who had a lot of difficulty there, and one day I got a call from her mother, and her mother said that the teacher was sleeping in class, and so her daughter couldn't get her work marked. And I mean, the mother knew her daughter and thought probably this was a misinterpretation, but needed to check it out. And what had happened is,
she thought the teacher was sleeping.
The girl thought the teacher was sleeping. When I investigated, you know, the teacher, it was the end of the day, her body posture was very slouched in the chair, so it could look like she was sleeping. But if the girl had looked further, she would have seen that the teacher's mouth was moving. She was far enough away that she couldn't hear the language and that the teacher's eyes were open. So clearly she wasn't asleep. And I call this premature closure. It's where a person with this problem looks at a few features of the situation and then makes an interpretation that isn't correct because it hasn't taken in all of the information and then runs with that interpretation. And this little girl, I think she was 11 at the time, none of the children in her neighborhood wanted to play with her because she was constantly misinterpreting and had a reputation as a teller of tall tales, which wasn't
this was
the
Vanessa.
Truth. Yes.
So you've identified 19 cognitive deficits mm-hmm. that you can work with. Actually, I thought it might be worthwhile me just reading the little subheadings of some of those, because okay. I think we'll all relate to them. It's officially called motor symbol sequencing, but the little subheading is, please don't erase that blackboard yet. Mm. Think of that kid in the classroom. Mm. Another one of them is symbol relations, but the little subheading is, I just don't get it. Mm. Or, I have a memory like a sieve. Or another one is, my words don't always come out in the right order. I mean, we can all relate, and many of you mm-hmm. will relate to different ones of these. Or people say I mumble. Mm-hmm. All sort of emblematic, aren't they, yes. of different cognitive deficits that you've decided that you can work with.
Yes, yes. And I work with people, I mean, from age 5, I've worked with people up to age 74. And some of these really, as an adult, impact the people in terms of the career choices. I mean, that one about memory like a sieve, I had an adult that came to me who was a pilot, and he had a lot of trouble with auditory memory, so he had to have the air traffic controller repeat the instructions over and over again. So he yes, exactly.
That's hairy.
I used to want to know what his flight plan was, so I would avoid flying.
I'm all into inclusive workplace practices.
Yes, yes. But he did address that area, and you know, no longer had that challenge. But also with the book, we did a lot of interviews and taped them, and we had a transcription service transcribe them. And I got used to, you know, as I was reading the transcripts, there was one transcriber that had the auditory speech discrimination problem, and I had such compassion for her because all day she was transcribing things that she was hearing. She couldn't read lips, and she was mishearing things. So one of my brothers, you know, was talking about my mother and making a joke and saying she wasn't cold and awful and evil. And the transcriber transcribed this as, my mother wasn't yet off the needle. So, I mean, my mother was a heroin addict, and I didn't know it. So it's sort of humorous, but and the Catskill Mountains became the Catgills Mountains. And imagine, like, this woman, this was how she was earning her living, but the struggle it must have been for her to have to listen to this and try to transcribe it, the mistakes she would make. And I could interpret it and know what it should be, but think if she was a court reporter. I mean, she wouldn't keep her job, because there the accuracy is really important. Like, I'm so humbled by kind of the people that walk through the door and the struggles that they have.
There have been some very extreme transformations, haven't there?
Yes.
I mean, some children have come in to the school, so they sort of step outside of the mainstream schooling and come to Arrowsmith, and they've barely had any speech.
Yes, yes.
How extreme?
Well, exactly like that. There's a little boy in the book that talks about once he got language, he described it. He said it was like a big pot of soup, and there were all these words floating around, but he could never put them together. And what's profound about that disorder is not just that he couldn't put the words together externally, he couldn't think inside his head. And one of the ways we regulate our behavior and control our behavior is by talking to ourselves inside our head, and he couldn't do that. And I had two individuals with that problem that ended up being sentenced to me by the courts because if you think about it, we run scenarios through our head. If I do this, then that will happen, and maybe that's not a good idea. And they couldn't do that, and we worked on those areas and addressed them, and you know, they're successful and don't have any difficulty.
This is a story full of positive stories, mm-hmm. but does the approach work for everyone?
What I find, there's some individuals that no matter how much we try, they've just given up. And we're very good at motivating students. And also the exercises are very motivating because there's mastery built in. So the student does something and they find they can actually master something, whereas a lot of these children have learned that effort doesn't lead to reward.
Are they rewarding? Some of the exercises sound really tedious to me.
They're tedious, but we all have mastery motivation, and the goal is that you start, you know, if the cognitive functioning is holding at a certain level, you don't want to start the exercise way below because it won't stimulate and there'll be no engagement. You can't start it too high because there won't be engagement, it'll be too frustrating. So you want to start it just slightly above where that cognitive functioning is holding at. And what the student does learn very quickly, even though some of them are not too exciting, is that if they put that effort into it, they all of a sudden master it and they move on to a harder level of difficulty. And about the 3 to 4 month mark, they start to see significant cognitive change that translates into their life, that they can, if it's the auditory memory, I've had students that come in and they've won a radio contest because they could remember the phone number, they could remember the instructions, they could do the skill testing question. And that's when it's really motivating, when there's that...
Lives are transformed.
That life transformation.
How have you in all this? So you started out kind of operating outside of the bounds of mainstream science. Mm-hmm. Have any neuroscientists kind of stolen some of your students and put them in brain scans and tested them neurologically to validate some of your hypotheses around what you're doing?
That I haven't had the opportunity to do, and one of the things I'm hoping maybe through this book is some neuroscientists might get interested in doing that. I mean, the challenge with using the brain scan technologies is it's very, very expensive to do, and I don't have the resources to do that, and I would be very interested in doing that. And
I'm really surprised that a bevy of neuroscientists haven't sort of pounced on you, actually, because it's the great decade, century of the brain, really.
Well, I'm hoping now that more people are aware of this work that may happen.
We're going to come to you for questions in just a tick. One thing that I found very interesting is that people, when they start addressing these cognitive deficits, they kind of discover aspects of themselves that they never knew about, like a sense of humour or an emotional core, you know, that they didn't know about.
Yes, yes. I mean, and certainly from my own experience, because of the reasoning problem, I mean, irony didn't mean anything to me. I mean, I definitely developed a sense of humor because I could understand. I mean, there's a surface meaning, and with irony and humor, there's sort of the underlying meaning or a variety of different meanings. So definitely with that cognitive exercise you see with the students, they develop a beautiful sense of humor. And also in terms of the emotions, I mean, if we think about, again, that reasoning problem, if one can't, you know, connect ideas or even cause and effect, you don't understand, like, why something happened. I mean, that's how Norman Doidge initially got interested in my work. We're both in Toronto, and he was seeing people in his practice that he felt...
As a psychiatrist.
Yes, that were coming to him that was really a cognitive deficit, not an emotional deficit, but was playing out emotionally. And so he started referring some of those clients, and we watched the transformation, that they could start to have insight. They could start to make connections, like this happened again because of this, or, you know, all of that cause and effect.
You really want to bring this program to Australia.
Yes.
Are you making headway?
Yes, I'm in conversations with some different organizations, and my real goal is within a year to have the program here.
Has mainstream learning disability circles and education circles come to embrace you?
I would say It's still mixed, but yes. I mean, my program is in Saskatchewan, one of the provinces in Canada, and it's in the Learning Disabilities Association, which, you know, a number of years ago didn't believe in neuroplasticity and this kind of work. So there's more and more recognition of the possibility. And what I find is once a school system takes on the program and the teachers start to see the kinds of transformations in their students, they embrace this program because
so
all
some
these
state
teachers,
schools are sort of taking it and inserting into their curriculum.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Hey, let's come to you for questions. And if you could keep them as questions, because I suspect there will be quite a few questions, so try and keep them fairly focused if you can.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for coming out. My name's Gavin. Barbara, I was curious, is the real trick of this repetition, or is it doing the right exercise? And like your story with the clock, was the stroke of luck there that you did it with the clock, or was it just the hard work and the repetition?
No, I believe it has to be the right stimulation. And each of the cognitive areas that we work on have different programs. And what we see is that the change is very specific to the nature of that cognitive area and the nature of the program. So it has to be the correct stimulation, and then there has to be repetition, consistency, accuracy, and what I call automaticity. Like you have to be able to do the activity, you know, and process the information quickly.
So that implies a real piece of diagnosis at the start, rather than just some random exercises.
Yes, and every child that comes through the program, or every individual, goes through an assessment where we look at the 19 different cognitive areas, and we say this one's functioning well, this one's a mild problem, this one's a moderate, this is severe, and based on the profile, every individual's on a tailor-made program.
You're taking people out of the mainstream school system.
Yes.
There are risks here, aren't there?
Not really, because what we find is in my school there are 8 periods in the day, and 6 of them they're doing cognitive activities. They do 1 period of math and 1 period of English, and they might be with me from 2 to 4 years, but when they go back into the mainstream school, the cognitive pieces are in place. They haven't taken history, they haven't taken geography, but they can pick up those subjects because they can reason, they can remember, they can think, they can problem solve, they can retain the information. And these are children that have been in regular school and haven't benefited, have been tutored and haven't benefited. It's really, I mean, it's our brain that kind of mediates our understanding and our interaction with the world, and if we shift that, they can pick up all of what they need to pick up.
Let's come to another question.
Thank you. My name's Sean. I was just curious about something general, like depression and anxiety. Is that something that these sort of programs could help out in, or does it have to be a specific deficiency that you're addressing?
It's a good question. I mean, what I find with a lot of the individuals I work with, because of the cognitive
challenges that they have. They have anxiety, a number of them have depression, and that gets alleviated as they work through the cognitive exercises. But if the, you know, the depression or the anxiety isn't related to one of the cognitive areas that, that I can work on, then probably my program wouldn't benefit the individual.
Another question?
Hello. You said at the start that that you developed this extraordinary memory as a way of helping you cope with the visual and auditory memory. Mm-hmm. Have you found that now you've got other exercises to help you cope with your problems, that that's faded a little bit, that it's not as necessary?
So it's a good question. I'd say probably aging has made it fade a little bit. You know, and I've actually started to do, you know, some of the exercises to work that, because this can work with just normal cognitive decline as a result of aging. Sometimes people think that if we're building a strength somewhere else, we're going to rob from another strength. And I don't find that happens, because once the new strength is in place, it's not taking energy from the other piece. Like, it's like they can all now work together and function together.
Another question?
Hello, yes. My name's Lloyd. Hmm. I was wondering about the upper limits of what the exercises can achieve. I mean, if you can read a clock or a watch perfectly well with the three hands, and you decide to engage in trying to read with four hands, five hands, six hands, etc., which I understand some of your exercises stretch to, is that likely to improve your ability in that area, despite the fact that you're kind of within the what would be termed the normal range for that ability? If you take someone who's exceptionally bright across all areas and give them some of these various activities, mm-hmm. do they improve even further?
Yes, I mean, I now have 10-handed clocks, and very few people get up to that level. And in fact, two people that parents that came through the door, one who discovered radio-emitting galaxies, quasars.
I was just going to say, it's like you're entering the 10th dimension.
Exactly. Yeah. And one who is the physicist from Harvard, they both looked at that and said, oh, wow, this is really exciting, right? They could actually see those relationships. So, you know, the average person could benefit from that level of exercise. I mean, what I ideally like to do, if somebody's had a deficit, is, if possible, not just bring it to average, but try to bring it to above average. So now they have a strength to kind of make up for all that time that they had a deficit in that area. I've also had people that have come to me with just average functioning in an area, someone that wanted to be an architect, and he was at the 50th percentile in mechanical reasoning, which is not deficient, but to be an architect, it is deficient. So I created a program for him, which I've now used with other individuals, and got him up to the 98th percentile, and he's been an architect now for 15 years. So it has wide application, from the individual that's really significantly struggling to people that are average. And across the lifespan, I've worked with people up to age 74.
Where are we next?
Hi, Barbara. I'd like to know more about age-related cognitive decline. There seems to be a big opportunity there.
Yes. Well, almost any of the exercises can benefit, right? Because it's you know, stimulating that area. But the one, there's an auditory memory one that I have, which is actually having the person have to memorize a lot of poetry, and that seems to make a significant difference in terms of being able just to hold information. And also the clocks one, which is the second most important brain area that we have, it makes processing faster. And so I think that, you know,
have you measured that in yourself?
Yes. The shift?
Yes.
I've started redoing that exercise. Yes. Mm.
Hi, my name's Paulina. I just wanted to know whether there's a difference in terms of the success with the subjects, the source of the cognitive dysfunction. So, for example, if somebody has a genetic, a diagnosis, for example, that might leave them predisposed to cognitive dysfunction, whether it matters, and whether you even engage in asking the reason or you just get on with the work.
If it's a neurodegenerative condition, like something like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, my work has probably limited benefit, because it's trying to go in and stimulate something that's already, you know, significantly declining because of a disease process. In terms of the individual I work with learning disabilities, mostly it doesn't seem to matter what the reason, and a lot of times we don't understand exactly what the reason is of the disorder, because it seems to be a static condition of a deficiency or a deficit, and we're going in and enhancing the function. So other than if it's neurodegenerative or things like autism, my work doesn't really benefit people on the autistic spectrum.
Is that
spectrum.
So? About Asperger's?
Asperger's, yes. I've worked with a number of students with Asperger's, which is the high-functioning autism, and the program that I have for the nonverbal reading and interpretation has had a lot of success. I mean, they still have Asperger features, but they now have the ability to read nonverbally and sometimes they
so
have other cognitive deficits.
So what do you
mean by
that, deficits. To read nonverbally, to sit there and read a novel on their own quietly?
No, to read the social situations.
Yes,
so it's like, say we go into a party.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're good here, you start sort of surveying what's going on, who's interacting with who, what the voice tone, the facial features.
How do you get them to do that? What are the exercises that you do to help
we
people?
We use lots of pictures. So they have to look at pictures. They look at pictures that tell a story. And they have to interpret it. And I mean, for the first while, they might be, their interpretations are wildly off. They miss the cues, misinterpret. But again, over time, through repetition, starting with simple pictures and moving to more complex, they become able to, it's really stimulating that part of the brain. It's not that we want to get them better at reading pictures, but that whole part of the brain that reads nonverbal cues shifts, and then they can go out into the social world and start reading those cues in real interactions.
Let's get some more questions in if we can. Yep.
Yeah, do you have any applications for your technique in rehabilitative use rather than developmental, like for patients with acquired brain injury?
I have worked with, again, not a huge number, but maybe 15, 20 individuals that have either stroke, aneurysm, car accident, and we've had success. I mean, the concern there is there still has to be some healthy tissue left in the area, because if the tissue's gone, I can't shift it or enhance function. But we've made, with those cases where there still is functioning, we've definitely seen significant improvement. Now, it tends to be, you know, we can't do as much as we can with somebody with a learning disability, because again, there's been obviously trauma. But I mean, one of the students that I worked with, I don't think he's in the book, he was 12 when he was hit by a car, and I saw him when he was 30, so whatever spontaneous remission was going to happen had happened by then. And the first day he came into my school, he tried to walk out a filing cabinet because it looked like a door to him. So it was like Oliver Sacks, the man that mistook his wife for a hat. He couldn't dress himself because, you know, his shirt has a tubular element, pants have tubular elements, they look the same to him. And as I created exercises and worked with him, I mean, what was so amazing, he developed this beautiful sense of humor based on being able to see things in the visual world. He also had physical damage as a result of the accident, so he would go out with people and walk in his neighborhood. And I remember one of the people that would walk with him called me up and said, this man, he remembered that at the house with, you know, the yellow house with the red maple was where he had to turn right. I mean, before he didn't even recognize there was a house there, that there was a maple tree, what the color of anything was. And that was a result of stimulating that.
Incredibly
that area.
Encouraging, isn't it, that you work with often people, by the time they've got to 30, they've kind of been abandoned. Any hope has been abandoned of changing themselves. And yet you're working with, as you said, adults up into their 70s and having an impact, which is just a wonderful challenge to the assumptions that we've always had about, the brain that changes itself, we age.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We've got a few more minutes.
So you've mentioned a couple of times about making exercises. How do you start that? How do you know what's going to work? How do you start that process?
It was reading a lot of Luria. I mean, going in and reading his description of what the you know, the different cognitive areas or the different brain areas do, and then trying to sort of intuit what would be an activity, if that's the function of the area, what would be an activity to work it. And in the early days, there were times where some of the exercises ended up in the garbage pail, you know, that I tried them and they had limited success. And so then I would go back to the drawing board and you know, try to figure another way in. And I think there are probably multiple ways to go in to, you know, stimulate the different brain areas. I've just come up with certain, you know, techniques at this point that work for the range that I can work with.
Let's have a couple more. I think we've got a couple more minutes.
I've got three questions. So the first one, do you anticipate you could find further cognitive skills that you could develop?
Yes.
Further than the 19
yes.
you've identified?
Yes, I've got some ideas.
Yes. Yes. The second one is, could you anticipate that these skills could be developed before the malady shows itself, mm-hmm. namely that you could be working with children in play to develop certain activities mm-hmm. that then result in guaranteeing more securely the development of these cognitive skills?
Yes, I believe that's possible.
A preventative strategy.
Yes, yes. And I believe, I mean, there's research even before that with, I mean, again, Rosenzweig's work with rats that pregnant rats, if you stimulated the pregnant rat, the rat in utero actually benefited from that stimulation. And I did have one student of mine that was expecting, and her child in utero was diagnosed with mosaic Turner syndrome, and so I was really excited that it's a genetic disorder that affects spatial reasoning, mostly in girls. So we had decided that I was going to work with her on the cognitive exercises, you know, while she was pregnant, but her pregnancy was too difficult, so we couldn't do that. But I mean, there's a possibility, even possibly, doing it before the child is born.
Hi, Barbara. My name's Manuela. My understanding from reading about your program is that when students leave the program, their cognitive improvements are permanent.
Yes.
And I just wanted to confirm that. Do you find that they need to do ongoing exercises to maintain that?
Or? No. And what I believe happens, I mean, I use the analogy that the brain is like a muscle, but it really isn't. And I think what happens is that once the area has been stimulated and it's working, it starts to get its own stimulation by being worked within the neural network, whereas before it's been a drag on that neural network, right? It's been pulling the functioning down. That's what I hypothesize is going on practically. I've tracked people 30 years out of the program, and there's no drop-off in function.
Hi, Barbara. My name's Dee, and we had a Lucrea moment with your book. So first of all, our son is 13 years old, and has pretty much, we ticked off every single symptom. Dylan is at a special school at the moment, but has been analysed as capable to go into mainstream. And we have him in an intensive auditory processing program at the moment, which has, exactly as Lucrea and yourself have explained, he said to us that he was in a dark tunnel, and now everything's nice and bright and shiny. So we're in first stage of intensely looking into opportunities for Dylan. So first of all, thank you very much for your amazing book. It's brought such hope to Dylan's long-term opportunities for life. We have two very quick questions. First of all, please can we enroll Dylan? That wasn't my question. Dylan was born with trauma. He was a premature birth, and our question to you is there a high percentage of the children enrolled at your wonderful school that have been brought into the world quite prematurely with brain trauma?
Yes.
Already. And is there a possibility that during development stage, going from 18 months through to about 3 years, where the perioventricular part of the brain is developing from lying to standing, was there any seizures that you can remember from any of your...
Your own... I mean, I've definitely worked with students that had seizure disorders. The work doesn't address the seizure disorder, but it can address the cognitive challenges that have resulted
you know, from that, yes, yes, if they're learning disorders.
You have to be quite careful here because you don't want to invest many of the people that might come through with false hope.
Yes, yes, no, I'm always very cautious, right, if I don't think that if my work can benefit, I want to be very clear on that.
Can we thank Barbara Arrowsmith-Young?
Thank you. Thank you.
Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, founder and director of the Arrowsmith School in Canada, joining us today. Her book is called The Woman Who Changed Her Brain and Other Inspiring Stories of Brain Transformation. Interested in your thoughts on this one? Get on our website and share some of your stories. Ciao from me, Natasha Mitchell.
How would you convince your friends to listen to the RN broadcast of This American Life? Tell us in 25 words or less, and you and a friend could be on your way to a unique cinema event. This American Life Live is the film of a live version of the famous radio show. But you'd better be quick. Screenings in capital cities across Australia are this weekend only. To enter, get the details from the RN Facebook page.